Good morning, WCI. It's good to be with you this morning. If everybody wants to go ahead and find their seats, we're going to go ahead and get started with our message this morning. I'm impressed there's so many people here. I was thinking Thanksgiving weekend, the snow. Excuses abound with holiday weekends and snow and ice. So I thought, God, I want you. You gave me a message. And if it's just Yolanda, Michael, and Tracy, we are going to have a good time this morning. So now I got to preach all the way to the back. Now it's good to see you all. My name is Michelle Warren. I'm one of the pastors here at Westside Church International. Usually you see me behind the keyboard or in some capacity with the worship team because I'm the worship pastor. But next to worship, one of my favorite things to do is to preach. So it is a privilege to be able to preach to you this morning. So welcome and thank you for coming to the church. This is our first year. Most all of you know that, right? And it's exciting. It's hard work. How many people know it's hard work to start a church? Yes, absolutely. There's actually more hands that should have gone up. That's how much work it is. But I have enjoyed being a part of doing the work. I like to work hard. Do you like to work hard? I like to see evidence to our work. And one of my favorite days of the month when we have our service is the first week of the month because, one, it's communion. And two, it's always our anniversary. We started the first week of January, and before we even knew each other's names, before we had started to establish our family and the culture of our family, we partook in communion together. And that's beautiful, because as the body of Christ all over the world, that's how we remember, that's how we reflect, and that's how we recommit as both an individual and as the family of God, that we are for the King and for his kingdom. Amen? So every first week of the month, I'm pretty excited. I also was pretty excited on Palm Sunday and Good Friday and Easter. Raise your hand if you were a part of our family and celebrating that way. Okay, all right, awesome. It's good to see people are still here after that time. But it is beautiful to celebrate first, and we did it with gusto because Easter is the pinnacle of the Christian faith. That is the holiday that unfortunately gets probably the most neglected by the United States. But the church, and especially the global church, this is the holiday that we just lift high the banner and that we exclaim that God is not only God, but he raised himself from the dead and that he gave us salvation and hope and eternal life, right? All right. And now we're getting ready for another first, right? We just had Thanksgiving. That was our first Thanksgiving. And now we have our season of preparation before Christmas. And that is a very important time in the Christian faith. It's important because it's important for us to know our history. It's important for us to know our story. It's important for us to remember and to reflect and to celebrate. And it's important, especially for us as a new church, because we're just starting to figure out what it looks like to celebrate. Because we at Westside Church International have said we don't want to just be a multiracial congregation, we want to be a multicultural congregation, we need to intentionally step into what it looks like to shape a global culture for a global God and for a global kingdom. Now, I probably should say that God is not just global, right? He's bigger than global. But the point is that God came for the whole person, for the whole world, for all of time. And we as his church need to understand what that means. And so these holidays that wrap around, these celebrations, help us remember that we're not just walking every day in a common way. We're walking with intentionality, and we're walking because we want to know who we are, and not only celebrate it, but we want to really lean into it. We want to grow deep roots in what it means to be for the King and for his kingdom. And so I'm excited about today. I call this bonus week. I've been a worship leader for a long time, and after leading worship for a couple years, every week I thought, I get easily bored too, by the way. That's a little bit of a backstory on me, is I can get very easily bored and I like to change things up. And it seemed like, God, you are worthy of our praise every week. But this seems kind of mundane. I know every Sunday is a celebration of your resurrection. Every Sunday is an opportunity for the church to exclaim and proclaim and worship. But I'm having trouble focusing on each specific Sunday. So I started to explore a lot in my own personal spirituality and then brought it into my worship leading. And that was exploring the Christian calendar. Now, the Christian calendar is not something that just appeared one day. And it isn't something that just appeared without intentionality. The Christian calendar was an actual opportunity for people to understand their history. Before I go ahead and explain a little bit about the Christian calendar, a little bit about the Christmas season, I want to tell you a little bit about what I'm calling back stories. You know what I'm saying? There's a back story. Now, I feel real close to pretty much everybody who's sitting out there. We've got some shared history this last year or even 2 years as we've been shaping the church. Some of you I've known a lot longer, and we're making current history together, and I don't want to minimize that. But I have appreciated when Mambo gets up and tells a little bit of his backstory. I've appreciated when David, who I actually know pretty well because he's my husband for 25 years, but I'm learning things even when he shares a little of his backstory, and Cindy and Jeremy and Johan. So the reason I'm using the word backstory, you'll actually, you know what? I'll leave it for suspense. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my backstory because that's what we've been doing as pastors. You see me regularly, but you don't know too much about my backstory. You love my future, and I appreciate that, and you're committed to walking with me into it, but you got to know a little bit about where I came from, right? Because backstories provide a framework for who we are and where we're going to go. So I'll just tell you a few things. One, I did not grow up in Colorado. When I start to tell people a little bit about where I grew up and a little bit about my cultural identity, people say, oh, yeah, I could have figured that out. All right, so I'll tell you this. I was born in New York. I was born in New York, and I grew up in what we call the tri-state area. So this very small landmass of an intersection of Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey. And the only thing I can say about that area is that there's a lot of people doing a lot of things very, very quickly. So people think it's a little bit of an anomaly that I would talk so fast. Let me tell you, friends, I do not talk that fast. And I work really, really hard, especially today, Ruth, I'm trying, to talk very, very slow because we have to translate. But that's the way we do things in the East. In the East Coast, we're not that friendly people. We do not look at people when we walk. We do not ask questions like, how are you? I mean, why would you ask that to a stranger? I mean, I remember when I moved here halfway through high school, and I thought, why are people I don't know asking me how I am? I do not want to tell them. I don't know them. Now, what I found out is, I mean, there's different cultures, right? So you don't ask people how you are. It's paralyzing for somebody from the East Coast to get that question, how are you? Especially if you don't know them. Because you're used to going into a very long story about how you are. Because nobody would say good. I mean, that's way too easy, right? And I'm going to tell you everything, but I don't talk to strangers. So that's a little bit about East Coast culture. Halfway through high school, my dad, who had been an engineer, and he was actually a nuclear engineer, so he helped design missile silos that housed nuclear warheads. So if you figure you got this, oh, he's an Italian. So you got this Italian-American, from New York, and now he's doing missile silos in Rocky Flats, Colorado, and in New Mexico and Albuquerque and all of these different places in the West. And my dad fell in love with the West. And he would come to cloudy, dense, overcrowded my home, the tri-state area, and he would come with things like cowboy boots and cowboy hats and cowboy buckles and say, you gotta come out to the West. And he would just be working on my mother. She did not want to leave the East Coast. We knew how it worked. Our whole family was there. It's interesting. If you're an Italian-American, you don't have friends. You just have family. So this idea that you would betray your grandmother, the lips that would kiss that grandmother, you're going to take the grandchildren and move where? Where they wear cowboy boots and belt buckles and cowboy hats? That's what we were afraid of. I thought there was no life west of the Mississippi. So my dad decided that at some point he had to stop visiting, and now he was going to take us all the way across to Colorado. I remember in Colorado, it was the first time I realized that guys were taller than 5'8". I don't know, there's some Norwegian over here. Let me tell you, they're tall. And then I started establishing rules like, I'm not going to marry a short man. And my mom would say, because my parents are the same height, and she was a pain to go shoe shopping with because she never wanted to be taller than my dad. So I was just like, well, I'm never going to marry an Italian. I'm never going to marry a short person. And mom, you can't help who you fall in love with. I'm like, you can if you don't date him. And so I had a 5-inch rule. At that time, when I made that rule, my sophomore year in high school, when I found out that there were boys that were taller than 5'8", and maybe I could wear heels, which I, by the way, love. You will almost never not see me in heels. I went on this mission like, I am not. I'm 5'5". The average man is 5'10". I've found the whole world that's over 6 foot here in Colorado, and I am not dating you unless you are 5'10". And I lived and died by that rule. By the way, have you met my husband? I did it. And I can wear heels. And my mother is jealous. I still don't like to go shoe shopping with her. And she definitely doesn't like to go shoe shopping with me because my whole world is a little bit bigger. So there's lots of backstories that I'll probably tell you on the times that I preach or whenever. But I wanted to tell you a little bit of my backstory because did you learn a few things about me? Let me ask you, does it explain a little bit more? Because these are the things. Sometimes I get texts from friends. They're like, what are you? Right? You're not white. You're not Latina. You're not African. What are you? And then I say things, oh, I'm an Italian-American from New York. Oh, that explains it. So anyway, I just wanted to give you a little bit about my backstory. Now I'm going to go back into the Christian calendar. So just to sort of switch you a little bit. And I want to tell you a little bit of the backstory of why the Christian calendar exists and why it's important for us to know. Partly because we want to be a multicultural church, which means it's not even just ducal. It's not just Latino and English speaking. We want to continue to explore. God, invite more cultures here. Help us to go out into our community and love them more deeply. Help us to have a posture that would say, we know, God, that you came for the whole person and the whole world, and we want to be holistic in the way that we approach and love people in your church and invite people in. And the Christian calendar is important to that because all over the world, Orthodox Christians, Christians in so many different subgroups, Catholics, there's all these different groups that follow the Christian calendar. And the reason that the Christian calendar exists, without getting too much into the history, I love to tell stories, I would love to tell it all, but I got time constraints. So I'm going to go a little bit quickly, not with my speed of my language, so don't worry, Ruth, but I'm going to tell you real quick how we got here. Okay, so back to my worship leading, I was a little bit bored, like, how can I change this up a little bit? And God opened up to my eyes to the way the world is practicing the Christian faith in this Christian calendar. So I want to bring you back to the Israeli people. The people who are the children of God, who have all these festivals, and they have all these set-aside times, not just Sabbath, but you've got different feasts, you've got different celebrations, and they commemorated things. Because the Jewish people needed to know their history. They needed to remember they walked through the Red Sea on dry land. They needed to remember that, you know, oil didn't go out, and Esther, and all of these beautiful things, that their people were saved. And so you see all these very intentional holidays to teach people who they were. Now go back, go up a little bit more from the people of the children of Israel and realize that Paul came to, you know, he was the apostle who was going to bring the good news of the gospel out beyond just that Jewish culture. And so he went into what we would just call a pagan culture. And it's human nature to want to set aside times and rhythms to celebrate different feasts and different festivals. And in a pagan culture, you were celebrating pagan gods and different types of feasts. And so you've got this Jewish tradition, and people were leaving some of that tradition because they had become Christians, right? And they were like, well, you know, we're Jewish and we're Christian, but we don't know how to totally intersect everything. And they were doing it. But then you've got this whole group of pagan people who, should they adopt all of those Jewish cultures? And I don't think it happened overnight. But the reality is that just natural tendency to want to celebrate and commemorate we started to, the Christians and the church started to establish this calendar that would celebrate saints, that would celebrate different times in the Christian history so that we would remember. And that's some of what the Christian calendar has kind of morphed into over the last couple centuries. See, up until about 100, 150 years ago, people didn't read. They were not taught to read. We didn't have Bibles. We didn't have a printing press. So when you think about all of the things that we've learned just because we're reading it, we didn't have podcasts. You know, so just because we, all of those different ways that we take in information, that didn't exist. And so the calendar was a way to teach people what their history was, what the theology of their faith was. And if you go specifically into Europe and you see stained glass, you'll see all of the different things from the creation of Adam and Eve and the world to the flood, because once again, people aren't reading. It's important for us to know our backstory. See, we love Jesus when we come to know him, but it's important to know the story beforehand, right? We can't just pick up where we start and move forward. We've got to understand the back. We've got to understand his coming. So that is kind of the idea of the Christian calendar, is how are we going to learn the tenets of our faith? And this period that we're heading into is to celebrate the arrival of Jesus, the birth of Jesus. We call in the Christian calendar, it's the word Advent. And Advent really just means a preparation. And I'm going to get into that a little bit more in some of my sermon. But I wanted you to understand that it's important for us to understand who we are. And I'm going to tell you a bit of, it could be shocking news. Guess what? Jesus' birthday is not officially December 24th. Did you know that? That he probably wasn't even born in December? He was probably born in the spring. When you look at some of the scholars and you study things, it was a different time in the calendar. It's not scandalous. It's okay. It doesn't matter. The point is that the church put it in December because if you miss remembering your history that Jesus came, then you are missing so much of the story, because we as the church, guess what? He's coming again. And so we need to understand that once upon a time, there was a story that Jesus was going to come, and we need to celebrate that he came, and that all that preparation, all that for his arrival was in place, and then he comes. And now here we are at the church, and we need to have that posture of preparation. And sometimes we frankly just get too busy, don't we? And we just sort of forget that Jesus is coming, and we don't set aside time to prepare. And that's why this month is so beautiful. Because it forces us in a beautiful way as a congregation to remember our backstory, to remember who we are, and to remember that we're going somewhere and we need to know. Okay? So this is bonus week. So typically on Advent, or that week of that month of preparation, in the American calendar we have Thanksgiving, and the way it lines up is usually Thanksgiving, that next Sunday, is that first week where we begin to prepare. And the reason I'm calling it bonus week is because Thanksgiving came so early that the Sunday after Thanksgiving just doesn't happen to be the first Sunday of that month of preparation or Advent. So bonus week is kind of fun to preach on. In the next 4 weeks, Mambo and Dave and Johan are going to take each week to talk about the different focuses of the season, but I get to talk about every single one of them. So I'm pretty excited about it. All right, so what I want to do is begin to tell you a little bit about the backstory. So I put a map, a couple maps actually, up on a slide. So I'm not going to teach the whole Bible, but I do want you to know that there is a story that's even beyond these maps. That, you know, we've got the creation of the world, we've got the fall, and at the fall, when Adam and Eve had sinned, God said, "I know this is your current sadness, but I'm making a way for restoration. That there will be a king that will never not sit on the throne." And so we see, you know, just a lot of different things. We see the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all the 12 tribes. We see them in Egypt, all of these different stories in the Exodus. And then we see this promise that God is going to give them land. And then eventually they're going to give him a king. So I'm showing that very first map here. If I had a little pointer, I'd point to it. You've got some purple and mustard color and gray and green. And what that shows is that Solomon, who was King David's son, after he reigned, that's how much land they had for the children of Israel. So there had been this promise, I'm going to give you land, and I'm going to give you, that's your inheritance, but I'm going to also send a way to restore and to satisfy what happened at the fall. I'm going to put a king, an everlasting, eternal king on the throne forever and ever. And so the people of God were waiting, right? They were preparing. And all of a sudden, you know, not all of a sudden, actually over hundreds of years, you know, we've got King David and his son Solomon, who had a united kingdom, lots of land. Things were good. Things were actually great. They were very well respected. But this promise that God was going to send a Messiah, that he was going to send the ultimate redemption, was something they were still waiting and preparing for. Okay, so this second map is showing that after Solomon's death, there was a lot of fighting among who was going to be the next king. And so you see a division of the northern and southern kingdom. So that beautiful landmass actually kind of got cut in two, and things are starting to shrink. Now, this whole time, we know in the story that a Messiah is coming, and now we're seeing some things that are really hard. There's some darkness. There's some things that are changing. And our kingdom, this inheritance, this plan, it's now shrinking. And now the prophets are beginning to prophesy. And Isaiah, go ahead and have you flip to Isaiah. I have a slide out here with Isaiah 8. And I'm giving you a little bit of the backstory at this point. So this beautiful big kingdom, this inheritance is beginning to shrink. It's being defined by war and fighting within family. The northern kingdom took 10 of the tribes, and then Judah took 2 of the southern tribes of Israel, and they split. And in Isaiah 8, you can imagine, okay, Isaiah is saying, you know what? The Assyrians are coming. You're going to be in captivity. And I think, obviously, the people in Judah were like, ah, too bad for them. You know, it's really awful. You've had tons of evil kings. This is what you deserve. You know, we're kind of death to the dream of us all being one, but you all are going to fly into captivity. And Isaiah starts by telling, of course, this is going to come to the northern kingdom. But then he says, you know what, Judah, you're not off the hook either. That none of you are following my heart. That there is an inherent in humanity and in people. And you think what you see is a problem, but let me tell you, what you don't see, the hidden heart is the truest of problems. You don't care about what I care about. You don't care about justice. You don't care about the poor. You don't care about equality. Read Isaiah 1. It's sort of the big summary of the book of Isaiah, where the prophet Isaiah, and in that day, there's some scholars and theologians that say that they took these words and they posted them on the temple. And there's some really harsh words for the children of Israel to say, you're going into captivity, not just the northern kingdom, but the southern kingdom too. So I want to pick up, in Isaiah 8, and then I'm going to read a little bit of 4 through 8, because this is where we're seeing some of the warning. Actually, I'm just going to read it off the screen. The wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Assyria. The Lord spoke to me again. This is the words of Isaiah. Because this people, these children of Israel, these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah and rejoice over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Therefore, the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty floodwaters of the Euphrates, the king of Assyria with all his pomp. It will overflow all its channels, run over all its banks, and sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land. Emmanuel. So this is the scathing. This is happening. Coming. You think that you're going to be free, but I'm telling you, all of this goodness is going to overflow you like water, and you will be taken captive. And then there's this cry at the end, Emmanuel. We hear the word Emmanuel in this season a lot, and what it means literally is God with us. So if you can imagine Isaiah saying, God spoke to me again, and this is what he told me. And at the end, Emmanuel, even in the darkest depression, even when we lose the dream and everything, God, you are always with us. So Advent, that first 2 weeks, we remember the darkness. We remember the hardship. We focus on some of those prophets and those words and those prophesying because you see the picture of what's happening, that the children of Israel, this promised people, were going to lose the very thing that they had been promised. But don't worry, a time is coming. And then you go into Isaiah 9, and I'm going to read Isaiah 9 to you, this one particular section. If you can imagine the darkness, it says, "Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. There's good news. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. Promise is coming. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned." Isaiah is telling the people that bad times are coming and worse even around the corner. Because what happens after Isaiah stops talking and Jeremiah and all of the way to Malachi, then there's 400 silent years. No prophets. It's not just captivity. It's the ultimate darkness. And did the children of Israel stay prepared and awaiting the arrival of their king? Just like Isaiah 9 was going to prophesy. And it said the darkness is going to end and there's going to be a light. And if you continue to read in Isaiah 9, guess what you see? "For unto us a child is..." We're going to go ahead and look at that, obviously, in the month to come. I'm not going to get to preach on all of that, but I want to set up the reason that we need to remember that there was a remnant under such darkness and silence, and yet they kept faith that the Messiah was coming. And some people who were supposed to be keeping the faith weren't even paying attention. So often the first 2 weeks of the season, we focus on God coming the very first time. But then Advent, or this season of preparation, hits us to let us know that, you know what, it's good to remember our history, but we have a future. Just like the children of Israel were waiting in darkness for that light, Jesus didn't just come and raise from the dead and leave us with the church, but he has left us with a promise, right? That no matter what the darkness, no matter what the world holds, as the darkest of the darkest nights, guess what? The light will come again. And so often Christians are very familiar with the darkness of the world. So much that we have decided that this darkness covering, we're going to go ahead and be smart Christians, and we're going to go ahead and have our flashlights, and we're going to have our batteries, and we're just going to wait for the darkness to go over, and God's going to come back, and he's going to rescue us. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, church, God is going to come back, and he is going to rescue us, but he is holding us responsible for how we wait. He's holding us responsible because he came. He came. He's a good promise keeper. He rose again, but before he rose again, he gave an amazing sermon, where, of course, he called himself the way, the truth, the life, the light, he was referred to in the Old Testament. But then he said, "You. You, church, those who believe on me, you are the light of the world." And that you are not afraid of the darkness. No, when you as a Christian see darkness, you actually run towards it. You dispel and you break up that darkness with your light. Don't hang out in your basement. Get out and run towards the light, because you are the answer to the pain and the darkness of the world. And as we wait and as we prepare, we need to remember that we are the light of the world. Light is comforting in darkness. How many people have ever been afraid of the dark? As a kid, I just always left my door open. Right, I outgrew that. But the reality is that human nature, you feel alone. Mambo talked about loneliness. If you're going to draw a depiction of loneliness and feeling scared, it usually is going to have something dark, right? But Jesus is a comfort. He is the light, and he said that we are his light too. And light's purpose is to shine in darkness. In Matthew 5, and I just have that verse up there, Jesus talks about how we're the light of the world. And then in Michelle language, not necessarily the actual Bible language, only an idiot would cover up the light. Only a person who was not believing and waiting with preparation would say, I need to put a bowl over that light and hide the light. No, the church is supposed to expose the light. And we are the light. And we need to take a serious look at how we view our role in the light. Right, my friends? So in Matthew 5, which is where this scripture comes from, and that Sermon on the Mount, you know, as Jesus' life and his ministry go forward, we see some things in Matthew 23, Matthew 24, and Matthew 25. And as I was preparing for this sermon, I actually never realized how important and central the chapter 25 of Matthew is to this season of waiting. See, in 23, Jesus does a scathing job of rebuking the Pharisees, these people who are supposed to be waiting in preparation and exposing the light. I'd read it if I were you. It's interesting. It's strong language. You can see why they wanted to kill him. In Matthew 24, it goes on to talk about nobody's going to know when Jesus is coming, but I promise you he's coming. And so he has all these different predictions. And then out of the middle of what feels like nowhere, Matthew 25 comes in. So just think about it. He's literally verbally rebuked all of the leaders and the institutions of the day in 23. In 24, he said, I'm coming to Ben, and I'm going to make a new kingdom, and you better be ready. And then he weaves three parables. And I want to go ahead and stick those up there. I don't have time to talk through all of them. I'm just going to talk through the first one, okay? But I'm going to challenge you, in your month of preparation, read this chapter. Because a parable is a story to try to help you understand what it is, the truth that Jesus is trying to teach. So Matthew 25, verses 1 through 13, I'm not going to read it to you, but I'm going to paraphrase it. I have it up, actually I don't have it up there. So Matthew 25, 1 through 13 is the first parable, and it is the parable of the 10 virgins. Because the way we wait is important. Actually, not just the way that we wait, but the very fact that we need to wait and prepare for God who's coming as the church is very, very important. So Matthew 25, 1 through 13 is the parable of the 10 virgins, and this is basically the elements of the story. There were 10 virgins who knew a bridegroom was coming. They were told to watch. They were told to wait, and what they were supposed to do was make sure that they had oil in their lamp and wicks so that when he came in the night, they would be able to see and go with him. And you know what? Some of them got tired of waiting, or they wondered if he'd ever wait. And all of a sudden, you hear, the bridegroom is coming. The bridegroom is coming. And five of the virgins, foolish virgins, didn't have oil, and they weren't ready. And so they ran to the other women, the ones who had the oil and who had the wicks all trimmed and ready to go. They went to them, and all of a sudden, they're like, we want your oil. And they're like, forget it. The bridegroom's coming. We need to be ready. Go get some oil. So they run to the store. The bridegroom comes, takes the five virgins who are ready, and by the time the rest of them had the oil and were ready, he was gone. We have to be ready. The lesson is we don't know, and it is tiresome to not know the end of the story, right? But we know our history. We know the backstory. We know that we're called, even in 400 silent years or 4,000 silent years, or whatever it is that we have to wait, we know he is coming. And when he comes, we don't want to be busy doing something else so that we miss it. And then the next couple parables are how we wait. The second parable talks about the talents. All of these different people were given a certain amount of talents. What you were given, what are you going to do with it while you wait? Are you going to be a good steward of what you have? And then that third parable, like I said, there's no way I can preach it, but you need to read it. The third parable talks about the sheep and the goats and says how you wait. Not only do you need to be a good steward of what you have, but you need to extend it to the poor, to the imprisoned, to the immigrant. And so I just want to challenge us, church, as we're preparing, recognizing that always, when has there not been darkness? And sometimes it's darker than others. But the reality is that we have the comforting light, and God has given it to us to steward, and we need to be ready. As I begin to wrap up a little bit of our waiting, I want to do a couple things. First of all, I just want to tell you, we'll go ahead and go to that next slide. with the pictures. Okay, so we're going to have 4 weeks of this preparation time, this Advent time. Next week, I don't know who's preaching when, but I think Mambo's preaching next week on hope. The second week is peace. The third week is joy. And the fourth week is love. And my challenge to you is, in this season of preparation, knowing that these are going to be the four focuses, how are we going to wait in the dark with a hope? How are we going to wait in the darkness with peace when there's so much unrest? How are we going to wait in the darkness joyful in the midst of what we see? How are we going to wait in the darkness with true agape sacrificial love? Now, these are questions we have to ask ourselves, because this is what the church is being called to do, not just to wait, but to wait well. And we have an entire month to think about it. Now, we probably should always be thinking about it, but because we don't always think about it, we have this time in the calendar to focus. And so we as a church are going to take some time to ask all of us to reflect and wait. Back in the back, we have our very first reflection station. One of our values is worship arts. I know we're working on worship. We're trying to grow in arts. See if you want to continue to help us grow. But we've got this reflection station, and we've got some doves. And thank you to Maritza. She and I cut out about 100 doves yesterday. We've got it. And I want you to go ahead and, did I grab the basket of doves? I feel like I did, and I dropped them somewhere. If anybody sees the basket, there's my flighty side. Somebody go ahead and look. Could you go grab that basket? Maybe Dionysia. I wanted to make sure that the basket went around. Thanks, Gary. And people had a chance to take these doves. I got a few more minutes. I want everybody who comes to our church on a regular basis, and anybody who wants to take one of these doves, because this is what I'm going to ask us all to do. When we think of the four things, hope and joy and peace and love, what is God calling us to do with regard to waiting? I got this idea because this year has been a hard year for me, and God started to convict me last year that I was not a very joyful Christian. I had moments of happiness, for sure, but that I had excuses in my heart for joy. This is my dove that says, go so, and I'm going to go ahead and continue to focus on joy. And God gave me this reality. It's like, Michelle, you are not a joyful person. If you looked at all the fruits of the Spirit and everybody had to put your friends and your family on a panel to say, does Michelle exhibit the fruits of the Spirit? They'd say, yeah, she's pretty loving. I mean, obviously, I'm not all of these things, but they'd say, I'd see love in her life and patience and long-suffering and all of these different. But I began to think that if they got to joy, I don't know if they could see it. Because the reality of the darkness that I was seeing and experiencing, both in my personal life, and just for those of you who may be visiting, I'm an advocacy director for a national organization, and I share this. I work to specifically look at some of the deepest pains that our country faces around immigration, around incarceration, around a lack of opportunities around education. And so my chronic seat is in all those places we want to pretend don't exist in our country. And so I can justify and say things like, I see such hard things. Of course, there's no reason to be joyful about that. And some of my joy was being sapped away and then dragged away and enticed in the sense that it took a root and I found reasons why I didn't have to be joyful. But the conviction came that if I was truly going to be the believer I said that I wanted to be, that I was truly waiting for a Messiah who had absolutely everything in his care, who said that you are the light of the world, that even in the midst of the darkness, I have to hold the tension of deep lament as the way things are with the deep joy that God has put in my heart. So for this whole year, I have been praying that God would fill my spirit, that I would not quench the Holy Spirit in this area, but that I would reclaim what is rightfully mine as a Christian, that I can have joy even in the midst of struggle. And so I wrote Goso down, and I'm going to spend some time writing what my hope and my prayer is around joy for the person I want to be as I wait. And I'm going to hang it on this beautiful apparatus that Stan built for us in the back, and I'm going to invite you to do the same thing. When you think about hope, have you lost some of your hope? When you think about peace in the midst of such distress in the world, do you feel like maybe the Prince of Peace isn't real? Are you like me where you feel justified that I don't have to be joyful? I'm a lot of other things. It's okay. Or are you robbing yourself from that joy that God can give you in the midst of such sorrow? Are you going to be a person of deep love? That's the defining first part of a believer. I'm going to end with this. I have a video clip that I want to go ahead. I'm going to call the worship team up so that they can start moving. I really want you to pay attention to this video. This video was shared with me by a friend. His name is Nate Bacon. He is a minister in Guatemala. He's originally from California. And he walked with a lot of the kids and families on the migrant caravan. They've arrived and they're arriving at our borders trying to seek asylum. And he was just hearing their stories, a lot of women, a lot of children, a lot of people who have gone through a tremendous amount of trauma because of all the traveling. I know I shared back a couple months ago of people that I had been interacting with when I was at the border, of people who are making this journey. And I'm going to show you a video of a 5-year-old Honduran girl. And she is going to be singing a song. And the song has to do with, I cried out to you in my loneliness, Jesus, and I knew you were there. That there's no joy without the wilderness. That God brings us through periods of darkness and pain, right? So that he can show that he is never changing. That he is able to give us what we need to be loving and joyful and hopeful and all of those beautiful fruits that the Holy Spirit has to offer the believer when we submit to him. We as the church need to be willing to be ready. And we want to prepare this season for sure and take the opportunity in this Christian calendar with Christians all over the world to celebrate what has happened and to celebrate what will happen by preparing our hearts and getting them ready to receive the King. I started this by talking to you that we do all things for the King and for his kingdom. Amen? I'm going to go ahead and end with this and just then turn it over to Jude.
Bravo!